Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
Well, today we're going to talk about just one thing. We're going to talk about purity, about having purity of purpose, purity of mind, purity of heart, purity of devotion. And you know, purity is a pretty good thing. You know, we're pretty serious about some forms of purity in America. In fact, there's an entire division of the federal government, the Food and Drug Administration, which is devoted to maintaining the purity of our foods. And I don't know if you've ever looked at it, but some of the federal guidelines of purity for foods that we eat are not that impressive. I'm going to share a couple with you, but I have to warn you, you may never eat again, okay? So, for instance, the federal guidelines, these are real. I'm not making this up. This is real. The federal guidelines for apple butter. Anyone ever eat apple butter? Yeah. Well, if the mold count is 12% or more, if the apple butter averages 4 rodent hairs per 100 grams or more, if it averages 5 or more whole insects, not counting mites, aphids, or scale insects, because apparently they're fine, per 100 grams, the FDA will pull it from the shelves. Otherwise, it goes straight onto your English muffin. Yay. The federal guidelines for coffee beans. Any coffee drinkers? Yeah, here we go. You'll be glad to know that the coffee beans will get withdrawn from the market if an average of 10% or more are insect-infected, or if there's one live insect in each of 2 or more immediate containers. Drink up. The federal guidelines for mushrooms. Mushrooms cannot be sold if there is an average of 20 or more maggots of any size per 15 grams of dried mushrooms. Yay! The federal guidelines for hot dogs, you don't even want to know. We'll just put that away. Yeah. I think there's something inside of us that desires purity. You know, more, obviously, than the federal government desires purity for the things that we eat. But in general, we think highly of purity, right? We long, if there's something good, we long for it to exist in its purest form, right? That's why we drink pure spring water, right? We don't buy polluted spring water in bottles, right? And that's why, you know, we like our oxygen, our air, without exhaust fumes, because we like things to be pure. And you know, occasionally there will be a person, maybe a celebrity, someone famous, who is so devoted to just one thing that their name becomes associated with it. Jeff mentioned a few earlier, if you were here at the beginning of the service, some people like Donald Trump, he's all about money, you know, he's about one thing. And Jeff asked you guys to tweet or text in, or twext, if you figured out a way to combine those, some other people that you can think of who are famous for just one thing. So let's see if we got any. I honestly don't know. Bill Gates for computers, okay? Yep, so Bill Gates famous for computers. What else? Elvis, music, all right, and any others? Maybe not. Anthony Weiner, Weiner. Note to self, stop doing this tweeting and texting thing. Okay, I got it. All right. Thanks for that. Thanks for that picture. Last week, if you were here, or even if you weren't, we talked about the grace explosion that happens in a person's life when they come to understand that a perfect God loves imperfect them with a perfect love. There's something, when you really get a grasp on that, there's something that just explodes inside of you. You're just overwhelmed by it. And that grace explosion leads to a new life. And what we're doing in this series is kind of talking about, what does that new life look like? What does it look like to be somebody who's experienced a grace explosion and is living in this relationship with God? And the way we're exploring that is by going through a book in the New Testament of the Bible called Philippians. Philippians. It was written by a guy named Paul, who was inspired by God, and it was written to a church in a town called Philippi, and so it's this letter he wrote them about this new life that we can have, and as we go through it, we'll put the verses on the screen for you so you can read along, and today we're going to look at the second half of chapter 1, and so we're going to see today that this life involves choosing just one thing to live for. choosing one thing to be like your highest priority. Like I'm not going to have a bunch of things at the top. There's going to be one thing at the top. And in fact, that choosing one thing is the best way to live. I would actually encourage you to choose one thing, whatever it is, that having one highest priority is the best way for a person to live. Now, personally, I'm going to propose today that you make Jesus your one thing. I believe that our purpose in life is best met and we find the most fulfillment and the most excitement and adventure, believe it or not, when we make Jesus our one thing. Now, if you're new to all this, it may be that the idea of making Jesus your one thing, your highest thing, may sound a bit scary to you. You know, you might be like, so are we talking about like weird, like zealots and extremists? Well, I understand that, but let's kind of talk about what this would actually look like and maybe a little bit of what it doesn't look like, and we'll see at the end if you're still scared about it, all right? So let's talk about Jesus being our one thing, which is what this guy, Paul, did. Last week, we talked about how he had this incredible experience that led him from being a Christian killer, literally, to being a Christian. And when he did, he decided that he was going to have one thing that he was living for, and his one thing was Jesus. And he writes this letter of Philippians, and if you read through it, you'll see that there's one overriding theme. I mean, over and over, the theme of Philippians is joy. Joy. It's like there's this overriding, amazing, pervasive, unbreakable joy that you can experience. And Paul experienced that joy, and the reason is because he made Jesus his one thing. And we're going to see that in the passage we're going to look at today. We'll see that no matter what Paul went through in life, he still had joy. Like, you're going to be impressed because we don't typically have that. He still had joy, and the reason is because his life wasn't about anything else. It wasn't about himself. It was about Jesus. Like, his whole entire attitude was decided by his one thing. So it's like, I just want to share my life with Jesus. I want to love Jesus. I want to share Jesus with other people, and I want to help them to love Jesus. That's like my criteria because I have one thing. So we're going to be in chapter 1. We're going to start today in verse 12, and we'll go through the rest of chapter 1. So it starts out like this. Paul writes, "Now, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel." So he says, what has happened to me? What's happened to him? What's happened to Paul is that he's been arrested again. He's been put in jail again. And the reason he's been arrested and put in jail is for telling people about Jesus. Back then, that was not tolerated. You couldn't share Jesus with people. And so he was thrown in jail for it, which is bad enough, right? But check this. Back then, sometimes, including the jail that he was in when he wrote this letter, you actually had to pay for your jail cell. So you had to pay rent for your jail cell, which is what he was doing. And what they would do in certain jails, like the one he was in, is they would have a prison guard, chained to you. And they would typically go in four-hour shifts. So throughout the day, you would have this parade of prison guards coming in and being chained to you. And so Paul has this experience where he's been thrown in prison. He's chained to a guard like some common criminal. He's having to pay for it. And I wonder, how would you react to that situation? If that were you, if you were just trying to go out and tell people about Jesus so they could know Jesus, you get thrown in jail, you have to pay for it, you're chained to a prison guard, how would you respond? My guess is we would be annoyed, we would be frustrated, we'd be like, man, this stinks. Like I'm trying to do a good thing for God here, and the way I get like paid back for it is by being thrown in jail. I'm chained to a guard like some common criminal. Like, this is ridiculous. This is just great. That's how we might respond. But that's not how Paul responded, because his life was about just one thing. It was about Jesus, loving him, serving him, helping others to know him. And so that's how he judged whatever circumstances he found himself in. So now he finds himself in prison. And he viewed it as an opportunity. Where others might have seen, you know, huge problems with what he was going through, he views it as an opportunity. Let's look at what he writes in verse 12 again and then verse 13. He says, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ." See, Paul thought, man, I get to be chained to people who don't know Jesus. This is awesome. What an opportunity this is. But to do this, Paul had to know his part. Right? Paul had to know his part. I want to illustrate this with this telescope. When you think about a telescope, there's kind of like three parts that happen when somebody looks through a telescope. There's three elements. There's the person who's looking through the telescope, right? Part one. And then there's the actual telescope. And the telescope has a lens, and the lens magnifies the third part, which is some distant, hazy, unclear object. Right, so you got the person looking, you got the lens that magnifies, and then you've got this distant, hazy, unclear object. What part was Paul? Paul was the telescope, right? He was the lens. And these prison guards are the people looking through the lens, and to them, God and Jesus are unclear, they're distant, they don't know him, and Paul's like, I get to be a telescope. Like my life, the way I live my life and the things I say get to magnify Jesus. For these prison guards, it's going to bring Jesus into the picture. It's going to bring him close. They're going to get clarity about who he is. And so for him, he's like, this is an amazing opportunity. And let's look at what happens. We're going to jump to chapter 4, verses 22. We'll be at chapter 4 in a few weeks, but he writes this. He writes, all God's people here send you greetings, especially those who belong to Caesar's household. Those are the prison guards. And so what he's saying is all God's people, the people who have given their lives to God that are here, because he's in jail in Rome. He's in jail because of Caesar and the Roman government. And so he's saying, hey, there's people now in this prison, in this palace, who have accepted Jesus, and they say hey to you. They're the prison guards. And so for other people, you know, it would have been a horrible thing, but not for Paul. Let me ask you this. Do you ever feel like you're in prison? Maybe in your home or at work? That feels like a prison to you. Maybe in your neighborhood. And I wonder if you ever feel like someone's chained to you. Is there anyone in your life that you just feel stuck with? You know, this kid you sit next to at school, or this person in the next cubicle at work, you are just kind of chained to this person. How do you view that situation? How do you view that person? Well, it all depends. It depends on what you're focused on, right? If you're focused on yourself, your problems, your accomplishments, your circumstances, you're going to be miserable, right? But if you're focused on Jesus, if you've made him your one thing, well, then this is an amazing opportunity, right? And that's why finding Jesus as your one thing, making him your one thing, that's the path to true joy. Paul continues. Let's keep reading. In verse 14, he writes this. He says, and because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. It is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry to him, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I'm in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. And because of this, I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice. So it seems that there were some people who were pro-Christ, but they were anti-Paul. Now, they were obviously confused because Jesus and Paul were like on the same team. It didn't make any sense to be pro-Christ and anti-Paul, but these people were confused. And we know that they must have truly been pro-Christ because Paul writes some other letters where he talks about false teachers, people who are out there teaching false things about Jesus, and he kind of comes down hard on them, okay? Because he's like, that is not cool. You can't teach lies about Jesus. But these people, he doesn't come down hard on them. So they were pro-Christ. But for some reason, they were anti-Paul. They were his critics. You know, there are some people who just seem to complain and criticize about everything. You know any of those people? Right? Some people just love to complain and criticize. Now, I started a church in Virginia Beach back in 1998 before we moved here and started Verve. And Virginia Beach is a little bit more of like a Bible Belt kind of town. And the church that we started was... kind of cutting edge, a lot like Verve. And we had a lot of people in that town complain about and criticize us. They complained about the style of music we played. They have drums in church, and about our lack of a dress code. The men don't wear suits, and the women don't wear dresses. And they complained about our sense of humor. For instance, when we first started, we sent out postcards, as we've done here, and some of those postcards had top 10 lists, the top 10 reasons to come check out Forefront. That was the name of the church. And just stupid, funny reasons like our preacher will let you call him Oprah. And we need more people for our violent invasion of Canada. Just stupid stuff. Well, one person actually sent back our postcard to us, and they had scribbled notes all over the postcard. Like one of the top 10 reasons to come, it said, Elvis is alive, and he preaches at Forefront. And this person wrote in big letters, liar! Another reason was, come for our weekly tribute to Swedish disco music. And this person wrote, is that because of the predominance of Satanism in Sweden? Do you worship Satan? It's like, who knows these things, really? Another reason was, we have a support group for people being stalked by their imaginary friend. And this person wrote, Satan? Question mark. It's like, seriously. Another lady called. I answered the phone. I said, Vince Forefront, may I help you? Which is how I would answer the phone, very friendly. And this lady said, I just got your postcard. And we've had this, right? It's like, you know, you're funny, and this is not church, and whatever. So I'm ready for what she's going to say. And I say, yes. And she said, I'm from Canada. And I said, okay. She said, what's this on your postcard about the violent invasion of Canada? And I said, well that's a joke. And she said, it's not funny. I said, it's kind of funny. She said, it is not funny. She said, I said, it is kind of funny. She said, it's not funny. I said, do you want me to explain to you why it's funny? She said, yes. Now, that's not going to go anywhere. You can't explain jokes, right? But I tried. I said, well, first of all, we're a church. We're really not going to invade any countries. And second of all, if we ever do decide to invade a country, it won't be Canada because our countries are friends. And so do you see the irony? Do you see the humor in it? She said, no, it's not funny. I said, it is kind of funny. She said, it's not funny. And I'll tell you this. I will never come to your church, and neither will any of my Canadian friends. And I said, ma'am, I think that's probably for the best. What do you say at that point? Like, oh, no, none of your Canadian friends? Does that include Brian Adams? What will we ever do with all the Canadian bacon we've bought? How will we start an ice hockey ministry? Whatever you do, please just don't send your Canadian mounted police after us, because to get away from a mounted police, you need a car. I'm going to go faster now. Bye-bye. We had lots of critics, and maybe you have critics. You know, maybe there are people in your life, and they just complain and complain about you. They criticize you. Maybe it's someone at home that you can just never seem to please. Maybe it's someone at work who's always on your case. Maybe it's someone in your school who just always finds something to pick on you about. So let me ask you this. That person in your life, how do you view that person? What do you think about when you think about the person? What criteria do you use to determine whether that person and their presence in your life is a good thing or a bad thing? Paul looked at these anti-Paul people, and you know what he saw? Opportunity. Opportunity. He knew that these were people were preaching Christ. They were making Jesus look good, and so he didn't really care if they were making him look bad. He's like, that's just not important to me. In fact, he wrote about these people, because of this, I rejoice. He's like, these people are criticizing me, actually bring me joy, because his life wasn't about him. It wasn't about anything else. It wasn't about being comfortable or successful. It was just about Jesus. And he's like, they're making me look bad, but they're making Jesus look good, so yay! That's awesome. But check this out. For Paul, it actually even went further. Because he lived for just one thing, and he made his one thing Jesus, he had joy despite prison. Wow. He had joy despite criticism. Pretty cool. But he also had joy. He even had joy despite the possibility of impending death. In the last part of this section of Philippians, he writes this, verse starting in verse 18 again. He says, but what does it matter? At the end of verse 18, he says, yes, and I will continue to rejoice. And then in verse 19, he says, for I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted. Do you know what exalted means? Magnified. That's what it means. It means to magnify something, right? He says, I am confident that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. So Paul's in prison under a death sentence. And he realizes what it's looking like, probably what's going to happen is I'm going to be executed very soon because I've shared the love of Jesus with people. And his attitude about giving up his life, about dying, is, if that's what God wants for me, honestly, I just don't care. Why? Well, he says, the only thing that could bring me down, the only thing that could bring me shame is if somehow Jesus wasn't exalted by my life. If I didn't serve my purpose, if I didn't make Jesus look bigger and better and bring him into focus for other people and bring him closer to other people, I would be ashamed. But if I need to die to serve that purpose, that's cool. That's fine with me. And the reason is because his life was about one thing. And his one thing was Jesus. And so he had joy no matter what happened. Paul single-mindedly chose to live for just one thing. And listen, Paul wasn't someone special. He wasn't like a spiritual Superman with a cape on. He was just a person. He was no different than you or me. But he was a person who made a decision. I'm guessing that Paul asked himself some really tough questions. Questions like, what was I created for? Like, really, what's my purpose in being on this earth and having this life? What can I do in my life that will give me real joy? Not passing happiness, but real lasting joy. Someday I'm going to die. What can I do with my life that will allow my life to have had an impact in this world long after I'm gone? Someday I'm going to die. What should I do now to prepare myself for the eternity that awaits me? And I'll tell you something, that was like the easiest quiz Paul ever took, because every question had the same answer. Just one answer. Just one thing. And he wrote it in verse 21. We'll put it on the screen for you. He writes, for to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. That's it. For to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. 12 simple, one-syllable words, well under his 140-character limit, very tweet-worthy, but they say it all, right? He's like, this is my life. Just one thing. For to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. And so, what about you? Are you living for just one thing? And if so, what is it? Like, what would be the tweet? What would be the motto, the summary of your life? Maybe for you it's, for to me, to live is money, and to die is to lose it all. Or, for to me, to live is to gain popularity, and to die is to be forgotten. For to me, to live is to have fun at any cost, and to die is to spend eternity regretting the decisions I made. For to me, to live is family, and to die is to leave them behind. For to me, to live is to sculpt my body in the gym, and to die is to have it decay forever. I hope you've chosen just one thing. And I hope that one thing you've chosen is Jesus, because he's the only one thing that will bring you the ultimate satisfaction that you're looking for and the true joy that you want to experience in life. He's the only one thing that will allow you to experience and fulfill your life's purpose and to please God and to leave a long-lasting impact after you die. And so have you chosen to live for just one thing? Most people don't. Most people never make this decision in their life. What most people do is they have a couple of things that all vie for first place. You know, it's kind of like I have this competition, and so my life is very confusing because I don't have one thing that drives it. My life is kind of conflicting, and it's very messy at times because I've got a couple of things. There's a guy named Bob Buford. Bob Buford wrote a book called Halftime, and he tells a story about how he felt that way in his life, how he felt like he had a couple things that were just making him miserable. Here's what he writes. Like most thrills, the excitement of making money was beginning to wear off. I had begun to ask myself the question, how much is enough? That in itself is not unusual, for at some point in every man's life, we begin to wonder, is this all there is? What disturbed me most is that I didn't have an answer. Now, you need to understand something about Bob Buford. When he was feeling this way, he was a multimillionaire. Okay, so it wasn't like he had a little bit of money. He had the kind of money we dream about. He also had faith. He was a Christian, and he was a Sunday school teacher in his church. He also had a great marriage. Okay, he had all that. And he writes this. He says, that is perhaps what was most troubling. If I had all this, why the panic? Why was I in such personal turmoil? So here's what Bob Buford did. He hired a high-priced strategic planner. This is a guy who people would pay like hundreds of thousands of dollars to come in and help their business, their company, to develop a strategic plan. But Bob Buford said, you're going to help me develop a strategic plan for my life because I'm sick of feeling this way. And he paid him all kinds of money to come in and do that. And so the strategic planner sits down and listens to him for like a day. And Bob Buford just kind of describes his life, and he pours out the detail, and he asks a blizzard of questions that he's wondering, until finally, the strategic planner stopped Bob Buford with a question of his own. What's in the box? What's in the box? Buford said, what do you mean, what's in the box? The strategic planner said, I can't put together an honest plan for your life until I identify the mainspring. I've been listening to you for a couple of hours trying to figure out what's in your box. It's either money or Jesus Christ. If you can tell me which one it is, I can tell you the strategic planning implications of that choice. If you can't tell me, you're going to bounce between those two values and be confused. And in fact, what he was saying was, Bob, you have to choose just one thing. Buford writes this. No one had ever put such a significant question to me so directly, and he was exactly right. I was highly motivated to serve Jesus, but I was also driven to be financially successful. I believe the two went hand in hand, and in a way, they do. But the reason I had such an unsettled feeling deep within me was that I had tried to put two things in my box. After a few minutes, which seemed like hours, I answered, well, if it has to be one or the other, I'll put Jesus Christ in the box. Buford spent all kinds of money to have this guy ask him this question. I'm going to do it for you for free. What's in your box? What's in your box? Are you like Bob Buford and most people who have two conflicting things at the top of your priority list? Or maybe you have a lot more than two. And if you do, have you started feeling the way Bob Buford felt? Have you started asking the kind of questions he was asking? Is this all there is? How come I don't feel like my life really has purpose? Why do I feel this sense of emptiness inside? Why don't I have any direction in life? Listen, I don't think you're going to find the answers to those questions until you choose just one thing. And if you do choose just one thing, and you make that one thing Jesus, I believe that you'll find what Bob Buford found. He writes this, Jesus Christ preached that he had come so his followers might have abundant life, life to the fullest. Most of us miss out on that rich life because we think religion is restricting and forbidding. We think Jesus came to scowl and say no. But giving God total freedom to use me in any way he wished did not put an end to the things I enjoy most out of life. The Jesus I have come to know is leading me to the path of a large life, not a small or narrow one. And I'll tell you, every person who puts Jesus in the box, who makes him their one thing, discovers that same truth. That's when real life happens. I mean, true, abundant, exciting, adventurous, fulfilling life, believe it or not, actually happens when we make Jesus our one thing. And you know, the funny thing is, everything else gets better too. When you put Jesus at the top, everything else gets better too. Like, you may have been listening to this whole thing thinking, well, man, Vince, if I did what you're asking, my job would suffer. I guess I'd have to neglect my family. I'd have to give up my hobbies. No. No, you don't give all that up. What you do is you give all that to Jesus, because he's your one thing. And so you take everything in your life, your job, your money, your family, your hobbies, your goals, your dreams, your interests, you take all of it and you give it to Jesus. And you know what he'll do with it? He'll give most of it back to you. He'll give almost all of that back to you with his blessing. There may be a few things that he's like, man, that's not best for you, and so I'm not going to give that back to you. But most of it he's going to give back to you, and all of that stuff is just going to get better. It's just going to get better because you're not asking them to be God anymore. You're not demanding that they do for you in your life what only God can do for you. Because we look to those things to give us a sense of purpose in life and this joy that we're seeking in life, right? They can't do it. Only God can do that. So when you make Jesus the one thing, everything else becomes really enjoyable and it makes you feel like it should, because you're not asking it to be God anymore. Listen, if you're in an authentic relationship with Jesus and he truly is your one thing, you will be a much better employee or boss. You'll be a far better spouse and parent. You'll enjoy your hobbies more and your free time more than you ever have. Jesus came, he said, to give us abundant life. That's what he said, John chapter 10, verse 10. He said, I've come to make your life better. But to experience that, you have to make him your one thing. And so, what's in your box? What's in your box? And what do you want to be in your box? I want to encourage you to live for one thing, and I'm proposing that your one thing be Jesus. Because listen, no one else loves you the way Jesus loves you. Your career didn't die on a cross for you. You know? Sex or drugs or alcohol might make you feel good for a little while, but only Jesus can give you joy that lasts. When you die, money is not going to be there for you. Everything else in life will ultimately disappoint you, but Jesus never will. And so I would tell you to make Jesus your one thing, to put him in the box. And you can do that today. You know, you can give your life to him today. All you need to do really is tell him. He's already asked. He's invited you into that. And so you just say, yes, Jesus, that's what I want. I want to make you my one thing. Once you do that, the next step, the Bible says, is to be baptized. Baptism is like a ceremony. It's kind of similar, to a wedding ceremony, because it's when a person says yes to a relationship with Jesus and is united in that relationship with God. And we're actually doing baptisms here in a couple weeks on September 8th and 9th. And if you're interested in that, maybe you have questions, or maybe you're like, I don't have questions, I'm ready. We have a sign-up sheet at the Velcro bar, and you can sign up today. But maybe some of you are like, no, I've actually done that. You know, I've said yes to Jesus, and I've been baptized. Okay. But are you really living for him? Is he really your one thing? Like, what do you do with your money? how do you spend your time? Where do you invest your abilities? How do you determine whether something in your life, like some circumstances, are good or bad? But by whether it makes you comfortable, but by whether it makes you feel good or not? Or are you like Paul, and it's like, well, it's just Jesus. Is it going to magnify Jesus? What makes you miserable? What gives you joy? If you've said yes to Jesus, if you've been baptized, are you really living for Jesus? Is he your one thing? If not, maybe you have a decision you need to make today. Maybe you kind of developed some faith in Jesus, but maybe you haven't made him your one thing yet. All right, so each week of this series, we're giving you another way to kind of interact with each other and with what you've experienced. We're asking you to consider writing on these tweet walls that we've put over here on the side of the room. And so each week we're giving you an assignment and the opportunity to write a tweet, to write a 140 character or less statement. You don't have to count characters, a sentence or two. And here's this week's assignment, okay? Think about this. Paul said, "For to me, to live is Christ. To die is gain." What's yours? What would be your life tweet? Not necessarily what do you want it to be, but right now, if you're just absolutely honest, what's yours? For to me, to live is it money? To die is to leave it all behind. What is yours? And so we're going to ask you to write that over there, and you may not like what you write. If you're really honest, you might be like, that's not what I want my life to be about, but it is. But maybe by acknowledging it, maybe by realizing what your life is about and the long-term ramifications of what your life is about, maybe that will be the first step towards putting that behind you and finding something better to live for. So we're going to have a song play in. We're going to give you a chance to go over if you'd like to write on the walls. There's markers. And during this time, we also have communion available. Communion is a piece of bread and a cup of juice that you'll find on the tables around the room. They represent Jesus' body and blood, and it's just this symbol, this sign, this reminder that you are loved perfectly by God, and no one else loves you like Jesus. He gave up his life on a cross for you, and so it's just a reminder. It's a way we have to look at our own lives and to remember Jesus' life and to thank him for what he did for us. So if you'd like to take communion, certainly don't have to, but you can grab it at the tables, bring it back to your seat, and after this 2-3 minute time, we'll close the service, okay? So let me pray for you, and then we'll give you that time. God, I know in my life, I made this decision. I'm going to live for Jesus and Jesus alone. He's going to be my main thing, my one thing. He's going to be at the top of my list, and I find myself living that way, and I find myself not living that way. I find myself living up to that commitment, and I find myself kind of distracted from that commitment. God, my prayer is that every person in this room would make that decision, because if we don't, we're never going to find satisfaction. We're never going to experience our life's purpose. We're never going to really experience joy. And God, for those of us who have made that decision, I pray that today would be kind of a reminder, a challenge we need, that I need, to make it again. And to look at our lives honestly and see maybe some places in our lives where we're not living the way we need to live, the way we want to live, the way you authored for us to live. God, help us to make Jesus our one thing. Help us, no matter where we're at right now, to get to a place where we could honestly say, to me, man, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. That will be a promotion for me. I get to be with Jesus in heaven. God, we pray all these things, and we thank you for your grace towards us that brings us into relationship with you and that forgives us when we get distracted. We pray it all in Jesus' name.